So I want to come back to, in a way, to this question of why do we use these old stories, old images? And much of the stuff that we're using, although it has very ancient roots, it really pretty much comes out of medieval times. Stories, songs, the Tree of Life. Now the reason that the material, they continue to be translated and moved on, so they're not just in aspic in the Middle Ages, but that's kind of where they reach a form so the Mabinogion is composed in the middle in the Middle Ages. Tree of Life is formed then. Other stories and poem, the poem Prithianun comes out of that time. But these are much earlier roots, but they're put together at a time before the processes that we identified this morning happen. So you're still living in the world then where there is a sense of the centrality of subjectivity, centrality of the human soul. All the various things, whether it's the Tree of Life or whether it's the Welsh stories, are influenced by the development of Christianity at that time. Because Christianity was the dominant zeitgeist. I mean, they're from a much earlier time than Christianity, so you find lots of strange other things inside them, which will become obvious as we explore them. But the reason why I use this material is because it helps us focus on the center. It's material that helps hold us. And holds us connected to this to another way of looking at the world, where actually subjectivity is seen as central. Even in the Christian Church, you know, the state of the human soul was considered absolutely central. You know, in the appalling belief system of the Catholic Church of that time, you know, the reasons that the state of your soul was central is because if it wasn't in good order when you die, you go into eternal damnation. So it was seen and obviously there's all kinds of horrible things that spin off that idea of senses of sin, senses of what makes a good Christian and what is a bad Christian and what makes a saint and a sinner. And all that is obviously not stuff we want to pick up. But what is also there is a sense of the centrality of subjectivity. You know, that biblical saying, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, if he loses his soul? That's really the kind of ethos somewhere. Also images of ideas of honour, chivalry, keeping your word, were seen, and these are echoes of an older world, but seen as central, and being dishonoured had a really different meaning. Obviously, the word honour, you know, the archaic was in some ways can be quite corrupted. You know, it's in the Muslim community of honour killings and horrendous things like that, but the idea of honour or the idea of chivalry, which you find in the Arthurian stories, and is actually really about the ability of us to connect with our own truth and that being central. And a lot of these stories are about about things having gone wrong and having to find our way back to a place of honour and authenticity, which in a way is very alien in a world, you know, where people there's a current debate going on at the moment, a political debate. George Osborne was on the news this morning explaining how he has got the EU to cut Britain's bill in half. And we discover that actually there is a rebate, that Britain automatically gets a 50% rebate on anything it pays to the EU. So 1.7 million reduces to 850 million, it always did. He's trying to pretend that it only did that because they argued for that. Maybe it's true, I don't know. But that's the point, you don't know. And actually people regard truth now these days is regarded as a commodity. Well, definitely. So it's very focused. So the whole thing in UKIP and all of that. So suddenly, but clearly, that one doesn't have, at least I don't have confidence in that in a thought that George Osborne regards his honour as crucial. And even if it were unpalatable, he would feel compelled to tell you the truth. Otherwise, he would feel dishonoured. I may be doing him a great injustice, but I don't feel that ethos. In public political life these days,
it's ego more than
well, it massively is. It's ego. But it's also advantage. Its truth has become a kind of commodity, like everything else. Right. So actually, so automatically, Ed Balls is saying, well, you're a liar. It was always going to happen. And is he telling the truth? I don't know. Who knows? That's one of our problems. But. This question of authenticity and honour is somewhere central to this whole subject that we're looking at, because it's about being authentic to our own experience, not dismissing it or destroying it, not reifying it and making more of it. Now this figure who's come into the room unexpectedly a little this morning, Brown the Blessed. It's a figure found in the second branch of the Mabinogion. And his story really is the reason why it can be useful to look at his story. I mean, all these different stories, I do love them, but I'm not telling you them because I love them. I'm telling you because they speak something of this capacity that we're trying to recover. So last time, the story of Taliesin is all about the energy of creation. So when I tell you the story of Taliesin, this is a Welsh version of this ability, of this capacity of the imagination to go to the root of things and to keep transforming. The story of Taliesin is all about the capacity for constant transformation. And in a way, the part of us that is like Taliesin is this infinite kind of creative being that keeps changing shape. And the image of that story is this image of these. We start in this in Penachin, the lake that is beyond the world. So it takes us into the beginnings of the world, the beginnings of our own nature. And we have this sense of how to put something right, how to the sense that something has gone wrong and that Moran has become this deformed, hurt being, and how to find a way to bring healing into things, places that are hurt. So the story of Taliesin is all about aligning us with a sort of a primal creative energy that can help us to heal old wounds, that can also help us to free people and aspects of ourselves that are in prison. Now the story isn't important in itself, except that it points us in a direction. So the Taliesin story has this image of this kind of cauldron, and in a way it points us inwards. The cauldron is the inside, is the subjective, is the contained place inside us, in which the essence of everything can be found. And if we look deeply enough into that cauldron, we find the golden drop. We find the pure energy at the heart of our own being, at the heart of the universe. That if we can receive that, it turns us into, sets off this unstoppable process of transformation that just keeps on happening. And as it keeps on happening, transforms us eventually through all kinds of different transformations into a being that can bring freedom and justice into the world that can deal with a corrupt, that can deal with a corrupt king and free prisoners from that place of corruption. So that image in the Taliesin story where he has to go down, where the king has imprisoned his stepfather, has cast him down into a terrible place, and on top of that terrible place, the king and his false bards, who continually praise things that are monstrous, are all stilled and set aside by the energy of Taliesin. And Taliesin can go down into the deepest, darkest place and free prisoners. Now, this is the same energy in our own hearts. When you perform this act of going inside yourself, you align with that energy, and the stories are different ways of depicting that. Now, the story of Bendigeidvrand, the second of the branches of the Mabinogion, is all about the art of bridging and the art of being somebody who can connect to that primal energy and can create bridges and bring healing out of opposition. And the story in the Mabinogion is on the face of it, it's a simple story of, but a terrible story. It's a story where lots of awful things happen. But it is a story about how to reconcile opposites and how to enable something new to come out of that, and how even life can come out of terrible places. And in a way, it's calling on that capacity of the imagination that can look even into the awful things that might have happened to us in our life, or the awful things that we see in the world, and can enable us to be with that and enable something new to come out of it. Now, the story really is about of Brann. Brann is said to be the son of Hlir, who is the sea god. He is this enormous being, too big to sit in a house. So we're talking about, these stories are talking about primal beings. So Hlir is his father, is the great sea god, the great deep, out of which all life comes from. Brann is this titanic kind of figure. And he is king over all the island of the mighty. He is king over Britain and is Prydain. And he, in a sense, his name means raven. He is the raven king. He is the... And the... What happens, and the Mabinogion's interest, like most traditional stories, it is like a series of vignettes. You get a series of images that continue to tell themselves to you in slightly different ways every time you tell the story. So one of the images, it's one of the things that begins with this story, is this image of this giant king sitting on the seashores, you know, because no house can contain him, looking towards Ireland. And he sees ships coming out of the mist, out of the Atlantic, out of Ireland, out of the Irish Sea, I suppose. But out of the far west. And the far west, the insular Celts, is also the place of death. It's the place of the ancestors. It's the place of the other world. So you see these otherworldly ships coming, and the king who come, and it's a king coming to Brann's court, and he is called Matholwch. It's an interesting name, Matholwch, because it's based on the word math, which is the old Welsh word for bear. And there's a lot of subtext here. So it is, but to keep it simple, in a certain way, we could say the Bear King comes out of the other world and is met by the Raven King. And we're looking, in a way, at a totemic marriage between the Raven clan and the Bear clan. So much so that the other side of Branwen, the white or holy raven, is given in marriage to the Bear King, to Matholwch, king of the other world. And everybody's very happy about this, and there is a great exchange of gifts. And something gets forgotten about. Now, these stories often have something that's gone wrong or something that is forgotten about. And Bran has two brothers, Nissen and Evanissen. Now, Nissen is the best of men. Evanissen is the worst of men. Nissen is a man of great calmness and kindness and love. Evanissen is this angry, resentful, furious kind of guy. And in the story, Evanissen, understandably probably, is not invited to the marriage feast of Branwen and Matholwch. Deadly insult. Now, what this difficult but powerful story talks about, because it is all about this place of inclusion and bridging, it is immediately showing us that there is a problem because something has been left out, something is not bridged. The fiery, angry, resentful place of Evanissen is not included at the feast. And from that absence, a lot of awful things happen. So one of the things that happened is Matholwch has all these horses, which Evanissen discovers his sister's gone married and he's not been invited. And what he does is to mutilate the horses of Matholwch. Terrible insult, really. At a time when insults are taken very seriously, these days we might say to Evanissen, get over yourself, but actually it's a big thing to be slighted at this place where honor or who you, your sense of being in the world is directly related to feeling honourable and therefore being treated honourably. So to be dishonoured in this way of thinking is to have your very existence obliterated or stained. And so in return, what Evanissen does is to do something that dishonours the Bear King Matholwch. And Bran is horrified by this, and everybody's horrified, and oh my, because hospitality to the Celts is this massive thing, and their guest has been treated badly. So one of the things that happens in attempting to settle this, and is it again a disastrous thing that happens, is Bran gives to Matholwch a cauldron, the cauldron that brings things to life. The story is all about things going wrong and things ending up in the wrong place. Because if Evanissen had been invited, no doubt there'd have been trouble, but the cauldron would have stayed in its right place with the king in the land. Matholwch and Branwen had probably gone off happily and done whatever they'd done. But what starts to happen because Evanissen and his rage and his difficulty is not included, everything starts to go wrong. Everything ends up slightly in the wrong place. So Matholwch is sort of mollified and sort of, okay, fine, I accept your gifts. I mean, I'm knocked, but we'll go off. And Branwen and he go back into the other world, back into Ireland. And for most of the time, she has a child, but there's great resentment against the foreign woman because of the dishonor that has been done to King Matholwch. So much so that he is persuaded by his nobles to put Branwen aside, and she ends up working as a kitchen maid, being beaten every day by the cook. So things continue to go wrong, things continue to spiral out of control in lots of ways. Things start to get worse. So she, who was intended to be the queen, therefore, of the other world, is now just a kitchen maid being beaten by the cook. But she is a magical being herself, and sort of, and teaches a starling, like as the starlings in the Mirabiration, she teaches a starling to speak and to fly across the sea to tell Bran that she is being dishonored. Lots of layers in this story. You know, we've got all kinds of stuff about men and women, kings and queens, honor and dishonor. And what needs to happen to put everything right. So what happens is when, of course, Bran discovers his sister's being really badly treated in Ireland, he gathers together the men of the Host of the Mighty, and they invade Ireland. He has to wade across the Irish Channel because he's too big to fit in a ship. And they invade, so they invade Ireland. And the Matholwch and his nobles are really terrified and kind of do everything they can to stop him from landing. So there is a particular river where the Welsh must get across, where they plant a stone that sinks any boat that tries to cross. So there is an insuperable barrier to the two things coming together to enable a resolution. It's really like some of the places we meet, I think, in our own psyche, where you feel that, you know, there's this and there's that and there's this and there's that, and there's no way across. And every time you try to get across, something sinks. Every time you try to choose, you fail. The choice does not travel. You can't get beyond the barrier. And the only way across the barrier in this way is for Bran to lay down his body. And in a sense, therefore, has to, you know, the act of laying down. This is the very, when we come into that meditation, whether we're sitting or still lying down, we, in a sense, we do lie down. We let the body be the bridge. We come into the senses. We surrender. So the act of it's complicated in this story because surrendering is not normally a good idea. So this place of laying down, so the most powerful being in that whole host has to lay himself down and simply be a bridge through which the men of the Island of Mighty can cross, you know, can ride across his body, in a way you could say ride through his body, so that the hosts can come together. Now these stories are always a bit strange because you would think, okay, now the great battle is going to happen, and that isn't what happens at all. Suddenly it shifts. You know, so suddenly Matholwch is doing everything he can to make peace, apparently. And he says, you know, he'll do anything at this point to make reparation. He restores Branwen to the place of honour, and he doesn't want to make war, he says to Bran that what he will do for him, he will make a great hall for him. So for the first time in his life, Bran can sit in a hall that can contain him. and that he will give, when he has made the whole, he will make a great feast for the, so that the men of Ireland and the men of the island of the mighty can sit together and feast together. Now in this story, Matholwch, in a way, is actually this kind of rather weak, tricksy sort of figure. You know, although his name is somehow relationship, there's another figure in the Mabinogi called Math, son of Mathonmi, bear, the one who is like a bear. Whereas Matholwch is not at all like a bear. He's not at all like a king, really. I mean, what there is in Matholwch is posturing and trickery and weakness. You know, his honour is offended in the beginning, he's blameless in that, but then, you know, then he makes an agreement, then he's persuaded by other people, by his nobles back home, that, you know, he's insulted and Branwen should pay for it, and he goes along with that. Bran turns up with his forces and breaches the barrier. Then immediately he's trying to satisfy Bran and promising to be good again. And in a certain sense, you know, if Bran represents the capacity within us to bridge over opposites, to surrender, to be authentic and true, and to do things even if it costs us, Matholwch is more that part of ourselves that tries to get away with it. That tries really to talk our way out of trouble, that tries to trick our way out of trouble, that thinks somehow we can, you know, we will be believed and we can make things all right, and somehow we don't have to bear the consequences of our actions and our life. So he's not a very good bear. Now, what happens is there is this great feast. Now, feasts in the Celtic traditions are these powerful events. That, you know, a lot of things happen in feasts. Things come together. It's a sacred thing. Hospitality is a sacred thing. If you eat together, you still find this in some parts of the world where if you take bread and salt with somebody, this is you become the guest. You become safe. You are protected by the host, even if you're enemies. For the time that you are the guest, you are safe. You are protected. And this was certainly true. So this feasting, this bringing together, this is a sacred obligation. And what happens, unknown to Bran and his men, what Matholwch does is he has warriors in bags that look like sacks of corn. Meal sacks, and they're waiting, ready to spring out and murder Bran and his men. So this sacred law of hospitality is being ignored, is being manipulated. It looks like it's a feast that's going to reconcile. It's a feast of love and reconciliation. Actually, is a trap of murder. Now, Evanesin has ridden with the host. This man of rage and darkness has ridden with the host to, you know, sort of restore his sister's honour. And Evanesin, who is this energy of destruction, really, at the beginning of the feast, goes round each one of the bags. It's very graphic, the Mabinogion sometimes. He puts his hands into the sack and feels the head of each warrior and pushes his fingers through their skull and mashes up their brains. So why is I know it's pretty horrible, it's graphic.
Yeah,
And he is this energy of destruction. And part of this story is about the importance of that killing energy. And of course, what happens if the killer is left out of things? So associated with all this stuff around anger and all of that we've been touching on from 99. So he goes around everyone, kills them, and says nothing about it. So they're all just dead in their sacks, and the feast goes on. And there's the crucial point where Matholwch makes the signal, makes the great shout, and of course nobody springs out of the bag. And Matholwch is exposed, and goes Bran, and everybody's furious and kind of, and Matholwch is held to account, and so Matholwch now is in serious trouble, and offers to resign his kingship, and to give his kingship to Gwerin, the son of Branwen, and to. And you know, he does almost the only thing he can do in order, having been proven to be a false king, he resigns his kingship and offers it up to the son, to Branwen's son. And they all kind of think, okay, fair enough, that'll do. And there's another feast to celebrate that. And so they have sort of Gwerin, little baby being passed around, and the new king of Ireland, and everybody feels good. Until Evanesyn once again intervenes and says, can I have some look at this lovely child? I am his uncle and I would like to give him my blessing like everybody else. Brace yourselves. Because Evanesyn takes lovely little Gwen, chucks him in the fire. And of course, creates total war at this point. There is no, you know, he effectively has killed the King of Ireland. Because Gwerin at this point, though a baby, is the king. So what happens then? Finally, total war breaks out between the men of the Island of the Mighty and the men of Ireland. And one of the great advantages that the men of Ireland have is they have the cauldron that Bran gave to Matholwch, which is the cauldron that brings everything to life. Now, in the hands of a true king, in the hands of one who is really aligned, a king like Math or like Bran himself, whatever goes into the cauldron, though it is dead, is brought fully to life again. In the hands of a false king, it only partly works. But it works enough. So the Irish dead are thrown into the cauldron, brought to life again, but cannot speak. They're, in a way, they're sort of rather like zombies, but they have that, they have the ability to fight and to kill. And because the Irish are continually replenishing their troops, it starts to go badly with the men of Wales. And then a remarkable thing happens. Sort of Evanesyn realizes, who's fighting in this battle, watching everybody die around him and watching the Irish continually come back to life. And he realizes that he knows that the only way that this war will stop and the men of Wales will win is if the cauldron is destroyed. And he does a remarkable thing that he pretends to be dead. He hides himself among the Irish dead and is thrown into the cauldron. And in the heart of the cauldron, a graphic description of him straining, pushing out with hands and feet, even as the cauldron is heated around him, and pushes and pushes and pushes and pushes and pushes and pushes until the cauldron and his heart burst. And so the cauldron is destroyed and Evanesyn is destroyed in the same moment. And then in place of unending war, there is resolution, there is total destruction, is then what happens. It ends up with sort of a couple of pregnant Irish women alive, and seven Welshmen. And Bran is wounded, it says in the thighs, it really means in the genitals. A poisoned spear is thrust into his genitals. And so Brahm, the great king, is dying, and he tells his men that he had to cut off his head and to carry his head back with them to Wales. Now what happens when they get to Wales is that they go into a special place, and the seven survivors are entertained by the noble head of Brahm. Now again, this place of the head being the place of origin, the place of that creation comes from. Now, Brahm is the very, in the Arthurian stories, Brahm is the very earliest maimed king. You get there's a whole thing in the Grey legends of the king, the fertility of the land and the fertility of the king are one. And the king, when the king is hurt, and he says very particularly in the genital region, then the life of the land. So it's a very serious thing. The king is the center point, is the place of origin. So if the create, the place of the wounds, so the wounded king, in a certain sense, has to dispose of everything about himself except his place of origin. In a way, he has to die and let go. And this is the story of this whole story somewhere. Is about if we do not include all parts of ourselves at the feast of the noble head, in a way, then what happens is those parts get out of control, they become separated. So the beginning problem that happens is evanescence is not included at the feast. So that energy, that fiery energy of anger, of wrath, and of clarity is not at the original feast. Now, if that energy had been at the original feast, maybe Brahm would not have given Branwen to Matholwch. Maybe also he would not have given the cauldron away. And in that act of bridging, which brings everything together, What you see in the story are all kinds of false attempts to bring things together, to cover things over, to pretend, to make a peace that is not a deep peace. And actually, what you see happening in this latter horrible part of the story is how crucial it is to bring in that energy, that wrathful, angry, killing kind of energy, that then starts to expose falsehood, that shows you the enemies in the bag, that won't let the compromise of the child being a king, because the king, the child, is not a true king. It's a political gambit. Because of course, you know, the king, the child, they're both all trying to save face with this. If they pretend the king, the child is the true king. So the child has to die. The destruction has to happen. And in a way, the cauldron that is out of place has to be destroyed. And only the killing energy can do that. And there's that extraordinary moment where in that moment, that energy, that killing distorted energy also changes shape, changes form. And what you're left with is that sort of devastation of a world destroyed, but you're also with the possibility of newness. You're with the pregnant women. You're with the energy that you're in with the feast of the head, where something, you're in suddenly in another space where something new can start to emerge. Thank you. Now, the really key thing about this is this is all about the art of bridging. It's all about the connection with the deep place in ourselves. Now, to be Brahman, therefore, is to be also to know your wound. To know the wound in your own creativity, to know the wound in your own genitals. So one of the reasons this is a very important story is not only does it teach us things about this art of bridging the inside and the outside, it also says we have to include all parts of ourselves that are actually are angry. There is an angry shadow left out part is crucial. It brings a clarity that otherwise we do not have. So our rage that we have sent away from ourselves has to be brought back into the feast and has then to do its thing. It has to get rid of the things that stop us relating to what is true. We have to allow that aspect of ourselves to destroy our illusions, to destroy our false compromises in order for deep, true bridging to happen. But if we can allow that to happen, if we really let that happen, and this is really what happens every time we enter into our senses, enter into a relationship with that inner place. We make the bridge with our body. We meet the parts of ourselves that try and stop us getting really to the heart of things. Because that movement towards the head, towards the noble head, the oracular head, towards the place in the center of being, can only be made by really entering into and destroying the false, the deals we have made to stop ourselves accessing those energies. And at the heart of that is a wound, is the poisoned spear in our genitals, a poisoned spear in our creativity. And if we find that, as we find that, then whatever is poisoned by that has to die, has to be cut off, has to be let go of. And we have to bear that so that then something new can emerge. And then what happens is we sit at the feast of the noble head. We sit connected, learning a new way to be. Listening to the songs and the prophecies and the stories that come from that new place. Deep, old place really, the deepest place. But then we sit with that and we have to learn those ways. And we're held in a protected space, a little like we are here, until we have learned enough of that, and then the door opens, and then the new world starts to come into being. We move out of the assembly of the noble head. And the noble head is at that point buried deep in the land, protecting the land while the new energies. So in a sense, it really speaks to the place where we have learned enough, then we go out into our life, into our world, into letting, but we are somewhere deep down protected by and connected to the noble head deep in the earth. We're not sitting at that level right now, because actually we need to be outside. We need to be from being, we need to be in doing. But that doing is connected to the deep head that's continuing to talk to us in dreams and symbols and metaphors. And this in Welsh tradition is a strong connection really between Arthur and Brahman. mean, there's some folk songs that talk of Arthur O'Brien, or Arthur Ap Brown, Arthur Stena Brown. And one of the things we look at is about is this totemic correspondence between the Bear King and the Raven King. Arthur is the bear. In the ballad Arthur O'Brien, he's son of Arthur the Bear, who is the son of the Raven. In another story, the Mabinogion, the Dream of Rhonabwy, which is another story about how people have become small and need to align with the bigness of old, Arthur the Bear King fights Owain the Raven King. So there's a repeating pattern here about ravens and bears. Now the bear is the great preserver, the great protector, the great guardian. The raven, of course, is the death bird. It's the bird of the Dark Mother. It's the killing bird. It's also the bird that dies in a certain way. You know, it's the ravens are the birds of the All Father, who fly around the world and preparing the road to Ragnarok, where everything is destroyed. You know, the in Norse mythology, that some of this material we're looking at today is covered by this idea of the end of the world and the great conflict that happens so that a new world can be born. And the wolf Fenris is released and devours everything. Fenris is very like Evanescen. It's this energy that destroys, that chews up everything. And you know, the god Tyr, the warrior god, has bound Fenris. But there's a certain moment where Fenris has to be unbound. There's a certain moment where the Evanescen energy has to come in, sweep everything away. And then something new can, you know, it's winter. Then spring can come. Now all of this sounds very poetic enough, but it's actually very literal in the sense of this is what we experience when we get present in our senses, when we go down into the deep place inside ourselves. What we meet is the places where we have agreed with ourselves not to challenge ourselves. Not to go too deeply, not to disturb the agreements that we have made with ourselves and with the world. In that place, our cauldron of creativity, we could say, only operates partially. It doesn't operate on full power. And in a way, we can't just add something, put a new coat of paint on the cauldron. That cauldron has to die. We have to go right down into the primal things, into the root places of ourselves, into the place that is called the head, into the place that is called the origin. And by surrendering into that, by letting everything else die off, then we're in touch with something primal, something that brings everything to life. We're in touch with the true cauldron which Taliesin guards. We can become Taliesin in that place. But we do that simply by trusting our experience, by this place of authenticity. The thing that's interesting about Evanescen, this terrible figure Evanescen, is he is completely true to his experience. He completely follows his experience. Everybody else around him is trying to do deals and trying to perhaps upset things. But he is in his rage. He mutilates the horses. He kills the enemy. You know, so one thing he does, this terrible thing. He then does this protective thing. He kills the poisonous enemies that are waiting to kill. Then he does another terrible thing. He kills this child. And then he does this heroic thing, kills himself and destroys the cauldron. What is going on here? But what he is doing is following a process, a living process, without compromise, with clarity. You know, it's the sort of thing you find, you know, Tibetan Buddhism deals this quite well, has this image of wrathful deities that are actually energies of destruction that actually take away everything that's between us and awareness. And that's kind of that's the energy Evanescen represents here. And in that process, Brown becomes deeper than ever he was. He becomes the king, the eternal king somewhere. Because everything else is stripped away from him. He becomes the king protector of the land, of the earth, deep in the land. He becomes, in a certain sense, the father of Arthur, who incidentally digs him up later on to all our great detriment, but that's another story. Now the importance, just to end on this point, the importance of this story is not to know the story, but the story acts as a pointer and a reminder to us of what happens when we do this. The key thing is not that you could forget the story, so you did the practice. But the things that are important in the story, they're like reminders of how ways in which we can avoid things, ways in which we can behave dishonorably, not carry a process through to its conclusion. And in so doing, totally miss the point of things. Because the only way out of this mess in this story is for total destruction, is to go down to the primordial. And you're left at the end with this image of the pregnant in Ireland, the pregnant woman in a cave, and the head, and in Wales, the head of the king, the entertainment of the noble head. So think about these old stories. These images are intended just to stay with us as contemplation images, right? So they are. That's what I say. If you read them, they're not like modern novels. You get an image, and then another image, and they jump, because they're like these vignettes that are intended to speak to us. So what we're trying to do here in some ways is a modern version of that. We're using these old stories and using them in the way that the bards would have, to let them come into us, to let them speak to us. But like we did with the cards outside us, we're using cards, now we're using a story, to let those images unfold inside us and tell their story to our story. So what I make of this isn't really important. What's more important is what you make of these images, what you carry with you from this day. What of Evanescin and Bran and Branwen and Matholwch are carried on in your container, your psyche. We've got 5 minutes left. Let's just see if there's any questions or thoughts about that. Otherwise, we'll just bring the day to a close.
Only the idea of the integrity of anger. As I remember, Evanescin asks at every bag, "What is this?"
Yeah, that's right.
Who knows what would have happened if someone said, "Well, actually, it's a soldier we've hidden. Would you like him to come out now?"
Yes, that's right.
You know, but there's always, when you get the stories about the devil, the stories about uncontrollable forces, they always have a real integrity about them, don't they?
Totally,
thinking about the most uncontrollable people, like the Sarge of this, who feels a bit of righteous anger that most of us, that has the clarity of the adolescent anger that we all felt.
Yeah, that's right.
Then we lose because we make so many accommodations to get by in the world.
That's right.
And people who sustain that can use it in a very positive way.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the important bit of the story, that bit we ask, as you say, every time he asks, "What is this?" Mm. And because he's light, we don't know, because he's light, then that energy comes into play.
Mm. It made me think of that Irish guy in Band Aid, you know. There was an absolute fury, really, with the injustice, inequalities in the world.
Yeah. Bob Geldof.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the simplicity. I mean, anyone more intelligent and more in tune with the modern world would have known that was impossible.
Yeah.
You know, but he had an integrity that made it happen.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas most people would not try, because we know you can't do that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, even after something, I went to see him just recently at his recent concert. And I mean, terrible things have happened in his family. His daughter died very recently. Mm. And she described him as absolutely raging on stage and saying that he felt, you know, sort of, he was wearing, I think, what would you put it? He was wearing his fuck off suit. And he wished people would wear their fuck off suits more and change the world. And it's that kind of energy. It's exactly that, no compromise, challenge.
I saw Jeremy Hardy, the comedian, he went on stage, I think on Why Is It, went on stage only about a week after his great friend Linda Smith died. And there was, I mean, he's a very clever and funny guy, but there was just pure rage all through. It's a very uncomfortable performance, very powerful.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't actually like it. I don't like being around that. Because to me, it kind of cuts through. But with no sense of the other.
That's the problem. Well, I think that's the problem of the unaware. That's the trouble with humour, actually, in some ways, because it's not an aware, because that energy that we're talking about, when it's held in awareness, has an acute sensitivity to other, an acute sense of awareness.
I just feel shouted at.
Yeah.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Yeah. No, that's no good. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't entertainment, you know.
Yeah,
one excused him because of these extraordinary circumstances. It was certainly from the heart.
Now, what's interesting about Evanescence in the story, he isn't this raging figure, actually. He has got this real clarity about him, so he isn't running around in an uncontrolled way. It is he does ask that question, what is this? What is this? And then responds.
It's interesting at the beginning, though, isn't he described as the worst? Or is he the worst, most awful man? So Nissen is the best, the loveliest.
That's right, yeah. And Nissen is this totally hopeless character that doesn't appear in the thing at all, right? So he's... And the problem is that, yes, exactly, that's the judgment that's wrong in the beginning.
So he kind of sets him up.
Yeah, completely, yeah. So he's ignored already from the beginning, and sort of, yes, he's completely set up by the sort of the expectations around Brown's court in some senses.
I was thinking as well, because in the end, if he puts himself in the cauldron, it's almost his. So I was kind of, on one hand, anger's great because it cuts through or whatever that clarity, but then it's. His own anger is the thing that destroys him.
Yeah, and it has to be destroyed in the end. That's the subtlety of the story. It's not simply saying anger is great. Mm-hmm. It's saying that yes, it is useful, but actually also. But once it destroys the false cauldron, the false container, it also has to die. Mm-hmm. Whereas you don't hang on to that and remain being angry man and running around. What happens next is a mystery, right? It's an explosive mystery. So he dies, and the false cauldron, which is the thing that's creating false life, you know, that isn't connected to true creativity, true life, dies, and that rage against that dies with it. And then we're left with that. So that's part of the apotheosis, the whole thing. Everything falls apart. And then we're in the new world. So the next images are the old king, sort of the Sobran dies and becomes the head, and the image of the pregnant woman in the cave. So we're then in a more mysterious kind of place, some new life coming out of destruction.
The original mistake. So the original mistake was he wasn't invited, and then Brian actually gives. It seems like he gives a cauldron in good faith. But what can I give you to make reparations? Actually, I have this. And so it's all like once the thing is done, nothing. I suppose that's what I feel a bit. So nothing you can do after that will make it right.
Well, what it's really saying is that you have to face the original error, which the original error is not to include Evanescence, right? So and it is saying that you can't make up for that by doing other things. Mm. You have to go right to the heart of it again. you have to go right to the heart of the situation, and Nissen and Evanissen and Matholic, and actually Evanissen he's listening to. What happens in that story he's not listened to. He's continually pushed away until he's needed in the war, because he is this powerful warrior. So the point at which he gets included is in the war, because then he's allowed in. You know, it's a bit like our anger is allowed in if we feel justified in our anger, but we don't allow it to inform us at other times. So it's like that. That's the original. So what it's saying is nothing. There's no substitute for including the Evanescence. And things only get resolved in the end when he's included, and his energies move into the center of the whole process. And in that process, there's enormous transformation through death. Even Brahm becomes this supernatural protector being, in a certain sense, bigger than he was before. Really, but he has to die in order for that to happen. He has to look, in a way, he has to look at the wound in his own genitals. Right, because what goes on here between these two kings is a real absence of kingship in either of them. Matholwch can't stand up to his nobles and protect his wife. Brân, instead of being a powerful king, is trying to make it up to Matholwch, and there's no sense of centre here at all. And so everything has to be swept away until you're down to the root, really. So the root of, that's why there's two images of the pregnant woman and the noble head. Suddenly is the place that you end up, and the place out of which the new world begins from. And so in a way, just to end on this point really, coming back to our own, if you like this, in our own life, is to come back to those primal places, the things, the compromises, the splits that we made in our own life, that have, and the parts of ourselves that were sent away that then have to be included, and in being included cause a radical transformation. So a lot of our beliefs, ways of being, ways of seeing ourselves have to die so that we can touch this kind of basic primal energy that then brings something new into being that will be different from before. And will be new, so there's a newness and a freshness with it. But all our energies have to be put into that somewhere. In particular, that place in us that is like Evanescence. So one of the ways you use a story like that is to look at the parts of yourself that are like these figures, particularly the part that's Evanescence. What have we sent away? Where is the part of ourselves that is wounded in our own creativity and life? The part of us that's like Brân. Where's the part of us that's like tricky, like Matholwch, who's trying always to manipulate? And to, just to see these places from, in a way, from, and what's the place in us that's like the false cauldron that looks like it's making things, creating things, but actually isn't really. It's a simulacrum of life because it doesn't include death. Because the thing about the false cauldron, why it's such a powerful image, is that it keeps on recycling dead things. So it keeps, you could say, reviving old patterns and not letting them die, but they're not fully alive. So it's a place in us that operates out of history and memory rather than out of presence and contact with our own life in our own world. So, on that happy note, I read these old stories, they're so inspirational. Sending us off with